This episode is brought to you by DistroKid.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, everybody. Today's guest is Trevor Keith, guitarist and lead vocalist for the Southern California band Face to Face. I've known Trevor for many, many years. Less Than Jake has had the pleasure of touring with Face to Face many times. The first time in 1997 as part of the Snowcore tour, and most recently in 2018. And we get along famously with these guys. Love the band. Trevor picked Disconnected to discuss today, and there was lots to talk about. Trevor and original bassist Matt Riddle were high school buddies who both had a love for Iron Maiden. They were metalheads, and they both came to punk rock a little later because they were more metal as teens, but they related to the pop sensibilities of punk rock. Disconnected was created out of a sort of mimicking of the Fugazi song Merchandise. Trevor talked about how he doesn't usually write lyrics first. The verse melody came to him really quickly during the writing of this song. We talked about how once Disconnected got added to K-Rock, it completely blew up their shows in California and led to a ton of exposure for the band. And I told Trevor that I still hear it played on the radio every time I'm in California. And Trevor talks about that anybody that has a long career in music finds a way to reconnect emotionally to songs that they wrote long ago when they play them live. For all this and much more, stay tuned.
Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
Wow, I got to thinking, and I don't know where the years went. first time we toured with you guys was 1997 on the Snowcore tour. That would have been February of 97, 23 years ago now. And I, of course, had your record when it was still on Doctor Strange, the Don't Turn Away record. I've been a fan since 91, 92. And Trevor, I'd asked him what song he'd like to pick from his career. And I was so stoked that you picked this song. I didn't think you were going to, because there's just, and I only say that because there of what we'll get into in a moment of talking about the different variations of the songs. And right. a lot of times artists, they're sick of talking about one of their most popular songs, but from a fan listener perspective, this is going to be great for the listener. So I'm really happy. Trevor picked Disconnected, which, you could have picked pretty much any song from your career, man. I'm huge fan. Love all your songs, but
thank you.
Lot to talk about with this one. So take us back now. This was on the first record. Do you remember where you were and do you remember writing Disconnected?
Yeah, I mean, it was some time ago, and this is the first time I've done a podcast like this where we're discussing a song, which is really great. But I was slightly nervous beforehand. Well, not really nervous, just I felt like really unprepared going, dude, what do I even remember about writing anything from that time period? But actually, I just kind of was chatting about it with my wife, and I was like, actually, I do remember quite a bit. So, now, hopefully my memories aren't, false memories. And maybe Matt Riddle, if he's ever listening at some point to this podcast, is going to be like, nope, that's not how it happened at all. But I remember some stuff, so we definitely can chat about it. I just wanted to say to what you were talking about earlier in the call when you were setting up the song and saying it was unexpected that I would pick this song. I just, it's one of those things, like, we make music and as artists, they're all our children, right? These songs.
Sure, sure.
And you know how devastating it feels to put out. Well, maybe you don't, because, you know, Less Than Jake has always put out nothing but top notch records that everyone loves, right?
So we've never had
any moments of.
Yeah.
Well, at least you think so, right? And we all do.
I'm a legend. I'm a legend in my own mind, Trevor.
All of our every new album to us is our best album ever. But
exactly.
If you've been around as long as our bands have, you've made records that have been more popular and less popular with your fans. So having had that experience, it's like, you know, we do this because of the fans. When you're starting out, you that's the only thing you hope for, is just like praying to God. Maybe someone will hear your music and connect with it, and you can share on that emotional level, and they'll get you, and you have that great exchange. And when you do have it, I think early on it's easy to take it for granted, and then sometimes people get way too in their own head, and they're like, well, I write stuff that's amazing. But the fact of the matter is some songs connect and some don't. And so I'm grateful that I've written a song with Matt. I'm not the sole writer of the song. We both have songwriting credit on it. And that it has had an impact and a connection with people. And we were lucky enough to get airplay in the 90s. And it's had a big impact on our career. So I think, you know, anyone listening, if they don't even know the band and maybe they don't know my name, they've probably heard Disconnected if they're a fan of punk rock, even if they don't know who we are.
Well,
90s,
you know,
punk rock anyway.
I got to say, that's very humbling of you to say all of that. You know, the importance of the fans. And that's why, you know, I'm talking to you right now. We both are still in the music industry, have a career because of the fans. Certainly there's songs from your career, from the Ignorance is Bliss record, the song Lost. I've told you this before. That's like, God, like goosebumps. You know, one of the most amazing songs, but like, it's not as known as Disconnected. And I would have loved if you would have picked that. I would have definitely chatted with you about it. We would have had a great show, but the fans are going to love this. So take us back.
Well, when you've run out of people to interview and I come back on several years from now,
which is gonna happen,
maybe we'll talk about Lost.
Oh, I got a few others. I'd probably do Walk the Walk before Lost, but anyways, okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. So take us back now. You guys, the first record came out in 91, but I don't believe Fat picked up Don't Turn Away till 92, correct?
Yeah, okay. You're right about that. And it was a very strange time for Matt and I, who really formed face to face. We were high school buddies, and we met because really a love for Iron Maiden. And we were more metalheads than anything else. And actually, Matt still is to a pretty large degree. And I've kind of whittled down everything, but maybe the band Ghost, I still like. Who's
love them.
Band. I still love Iron Maiden, of course. But in terms of contemporary metal, I think Matt's still very much into the scene, and I'm not. Anyhow, we kind of got frustrated trying to get metal bands off the ground. And Matt certainly had the chops for it. But, you know, I was a stocky dude, and still am, with a deep voice. And it just didn't really fit that metal kind of dynamic. And we were just trying to reach out creatively, and we kind of went in a new wave direction, almost like The Cure, the Psychedelic Furs, and the Smiths. And we have some early demos that reflect that songwriting, but we're kind of, you know, I would consider us Johnny come latelys to punk rock in our lives. Anyway, we weren't like, you know, young, angry teens skateboarding around town, listening to DI and Adolescence and Dead Kennedys. We were metal during that time of our lives.
Right.
So when I discovered punk rock, I was in my late teens, early 20s. And it was, you know, I was listening to records like Bad Religions, No Control, and then later Against the Grain, and The Descendants. I think the Two Things at Once record was the one I was able to find at the time that I just absolutely loved. And I related immediately to like the pop sensibilities of that kind of music. But also at the time, another band that was introduced to me was Fugazi. And I think the newest record at the time was Repeater. Mm-hmm. And I loved the song Merchandise. which has that jink-jink-jink kind of guitar part in it, that the two kind of octave-y things that you play very rhythmically.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of what we were doing as a punk rock band in the very beginning was just kind of jamming these riffs that we were familiar with that maybe we were kind of able to play in our rehearsal room. And so Disconnected was sort of born out of that mimicking of wanting to do that Fugazi riff from Merchandise, at least on my part.
Wow. Okay.
My background wasn't in guitar. I started as a singer, and then I played, like, as cheesy as it sounds, I was playing keyboards.
And I can't see you playing keyboards. You're a big stocky guy.
when I was a kid, my introduction to music was keyboard, piano, organ, synthesizer.
Mine too.
So, okay, cool. I mean, I'm talking, I was like 12 years old.
So yeah, I was 10 when I took lessons. Yeah.
So I didn't pick up a guitar first. But around 14, 15, I wanted to be in bands. So I took some vocal lessons, and I was the singer early on. And then guitar was something that came later, at like out of a necessity. So I learned to play some basic rock guitar, and that's kind of where I still am today. So my early mimicking of that Fugazi riff on the B chord, you know, using the low E string and then mm-hmm. hitting the octave and just going gang. We were just kind of like having a jam session at practice, you know, like, I'm sure you've experienced this multitudes of times. Maybe you still do. I hate when this happens now that I'm older and I've been doing music for 30 plus years. But, you know, like when you're at rehearsal and everyone just starts playing their own stupid song, like everyone's just riffing.
Yeah. It's like you're at Guitar Center all of a sudden.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like, can we organize this? Like, shut up, everybody. That still happens, but not much, not as much these days. But it was very much happening back in 91. 92 when we were writing those early songs that would be Don't Turn Away. And so Disconnected was me doing that riff, and then Matt started playing what are the four, you know, tonic chord or notes behind it.
Yeah, your root notes. Yeah.
And then we were like, I remember we were doing that for a while, and then eventually Rob, our drummer at the time, just started playing a beat that supported it. And we were sort of just, you know, playing that over and over and over and over again, and just kind of really enjoying how all that fit together, you know, that kind of spark. And we're like, are we writing a new song? Like, this seems really cool. Let's keep playing it kind of vibe. And I don't normally write lyrics first. I'll write a melody, and then lyrics will follow once I've established what the melodic structure of the song is and the rhythm of it. So but I remember that melody came to me really quick, not the chorus, the verse melody, the na 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 na, mm-hmm. and that was going over these parts that we were all doing individually. I don't think the song developed much further from there in that moment. It might have, because one of the challenges we put to ourselves was to, we'd written a bunch of other songs too for Don't Turn Away, but this one was like, could we make a song where we never change the chord progression? Like, and it was kind of a challenge to us, as to Matt and I as songwriters, like, would it be kind of fun, and would it be possible to do that for 3-4 minutes, whatever a pop song length is? And could we maybe just only vary the song with arrangement rather than chord progression? And so that was the challenge of Disconnected. And so that's why the guitars are just kind of holding that B octave mm-hmm. throughout the verse, and the bass does all the changes to make that, you know, that relationship between those notes. And then when the chorus is, the guitar then joins the bass and does the big chords. And then you have that anthemic, no, kind of thing. Let our inhibition just go. Go! so yeah, that was sort of how that song came about. And anyone who's a Descendants fan would almost immediately recognize that "you don't know what you would give up" line was inspired by, I mean, clearly I was listening to a lot of the Descendants at the time.
And, sure. Yeah.
And I think that line was just in my brain, which is, you know, from a completely different style of song, which is, "I'm gonna be the only one." Wait, what's the name of that song?
"Now you want perfection. I see self-destruction. You don't know what you want. It's gonna take you years to find out. I'm not giving up."
So,
The song is called "Hope." By the way,
"Hope." It's "Hope." Thank you.
Why Thank couldn't you. I kept wanting to say "bikage" because you guys, it's not "bikage" because I know. Yeah,
I wasn't going
to
say "all logistics." I know.
No.
But yeah. Okay. "Hope," of course.
Yeah. So now the first version was recorded with Donnell Cameron, and that first version is what made "Don't Turn Away." Correct. Made the record.
Let me. Actually, no.
Because I got some notes here. Let me go through it. So the first version was recorded, I believe, with Donnell, but then it was re-recorded with Jim Goodwin. Did the Jim Goodwin version make the Fat Records edition re-release of "Don't Turn Away"?
Well, it's a little more complex than that, and maybe the liner notes in the history doesn't reflect it.
Okay, and the reason I want to talk about this, because it's fascinating to me, and I hope it is for the listeners, is to see how songs just go through, you know, just different changes. You re-record them sometimes at the behest of the record label, and we'll get to that in a moment when you get to re-record it for Big Choice. But so the first version, who recorded that one, produced that one?
The Jim Goodwin version that is on "Don't Turn Away" is the first version of "Disconnected."
Okay. Okay. And then Jim did remix it for the "Over It" EP, correct?
No. Actually, that was remixed by Geza X.
Wikipedia, you're screwing me here. Okay.
Yeah. So you know, come on. Wikipedia is just people. It's just fans going, I know what happened.
Okay. Jim had recorded.
I never thought it was very interesting before, but I'll tell you the real story.
Please do.
So when we were writing the songs that would initially be "Don't Turn Away," I think, you know, only maybe 6 or 8 of those ended up going on "Don't Turn Away." So we met Bill Plaster, who was known as Dr. Strange, Strange Records in Inland Empire. And we became buddies. He liked our music. I think we were booked on a show that was going to be like a Doctor Strange showcase night, and it was canceled. So I got in touch with Bill and I was like, "Are you going to redo this? Because this would be a great showcase for our band." And so it ended up that we did a rescheduled show at the Green Door in Ontario. And Bill and his wife at the time, Kim, came out and watched our band, and they'd never seen us before, or heard us. And they liked it right away. And we were like, holy shit, because we were a brand new band at the time. So any encouragement we got from anyone, we were like, oh my God, dude, this is going to be it. You know, like you're so naive and you think that some little tiny thing is going to change it all for you. But in a lot of ways that did, because Bill had been running a really successful mail order business. You got to remember, this is all pre-internet.
Sure.
He would find rare punk rock records and then resell them. So like he'd go scour the record stores that were local to him, find cool punk rock records that were rare, vintage or whatever, and then resell them mostly overseas, I think, where other people couldn't find it. And he was doing pretty well for himself as a side gig. I think it eventually took over his job. And then he started putting his own records out, you know, bands like Manson Youth and the Bolsheviks and some other stuff that was really early.
Well, Rhythm Collision is how I heard about you guys.
Rhythm Collision. Yeah. Well, they were like the only pop punk kind of band I think, in those early days.
And I had their 7-inch, and in the liner notes of the 7-inch, you know, remember they used to stick little flyers in there of upcoming releases.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And that's how I heard "Don't Turn Away."
Oh, nice. Excellent.
Yeah.
So, what I was going to say is, Bill wasn't in a position to like make a record with us, but, no, actually that is how that happened. He said, if you guys have enough songs for a record, I'd like to hear them. And then I'll go ahead and pay the recording fees for you guys to go and record everything. And it was, I don't know how much money was spent, but the budget was such that we were only able to do 2 weekends at West Beach. So Saturday and a Sunday, and then the following week, a Saturday and a Sunday. So all of those songs were recorded and mixed in those 4 days.
Wow.
Yeah. It was gnarly.
And for as young and I'll use the term, a young and as green as you were, I mean, the record, it still has a magic to it. It sounds great. I mean, considering this is pre-Pro Tools, I mean, you were going, I'm assuming, straight to 2-inch tape.
Straight to tape. Yeah. There wasn't a lot of thought about, like, well, let's do that one again. It was like, if we were able to cut a track without a mistake in it, we were mm-hmm. done. There wasn't like, can you do that one and make it a little bit more emotive on the second line?
Yeah,
there wasn't any of that bullshit. You know, it was just
let's do a third harmony on that. Yeah.
So we just got in there and made that record, and it was awesome. It was at West Beach, which is what Bill wanted to do with Donnell Cameron. And basically, Donnell Cameron, for people that aren't familiar, if it wasn't going to be Brett Gerwitz, it was Don Cameron. Like, those were the two engineers at West Beach. And most people know West Beach because they know that Brett co-owned the studio with Don. And, of course, all those great Bad Religion records came out of there, mm-hmm. Along with a ton of other great stuff. I don't even think they have that location and haven't for a long time. But it was a really great experience. Apparently, the studio might have been owned at Stevie Wonder at one point.
Really?
Yeah, it was a cool studio. It wasn't huge, but it had it was long and narrow. It was right down in Hollywood by a bunch of other great studios and stuff that we would later record at. And it just had a cool vibe. It was a great place to work. We got along great with Don. He taught us a lot about recording and how to get good guitar sounds and all that. And we recorded, I think, maybe 8 to 10 songs. And this is where my memory is going to fail me a little bit, because I don't remember specifically what they were, but some of them would end up being outtakes. Songs like Pain, which was a version that ended up, we pillaged like some of that song and ended up rewriting it in the form of the song Promises on our second record.
Oh, okay.
And a couple other, it was a song called Who You Are, I think. And these songs have resurfaced on comps or whatever throughout the years. There were just a few of the songs that we weren't 100% with. But anyway, we recorded that batch of songs with Don. And then we kept going and we played shows very regularly around Southern California. And one night at a show we were doing at Raji's, but this was before the record came out, which was an old, kind of well-known venue in Hollywood. We met this guy, Jim Goodwin, and we kind of thought it was a put on, because Jim came straight up to us and said, hey, I like your band, and I work at this studio that's this really amazing studio. He goes, I'm a new staff engineer there, and they allow me to record bands on the side whenever I want for free. And I really like to record your band. Do you have any music? So this was between the time that we recorded that stuff for Don, and then Bill had plans to take one of those songs and put them on a comp, which was called A Strange Compilation. It was only printed on vinyl, limited edition. And it was us and Rhythm Collision and Manson Youth and the Bolsheviks and I think Guttermouth and whatever bands Bill was working with at the time from the Inland Empire. That was the first release we ever appeared on. And then I think we may or may not have put out the No Authority 7-inch as well, okay, which was from those sessions. So, and that was leading up to the release of Don't Turn Away. That could be out of time. I'm not sure if I have the timeline right on that. Anyway.
Do you recall playing shows prior to the song coming out on Don't Turn Away? Do you remember the audience reaction when you played Disconnected the first half dozen times or so? Do you remember it connecting at all or resonating?
I don't remember that particular song standing out more than any of the other songs in our set. And you mentioned that you wanted to talk more about what ultimately would become of Disconnected and how we would re-record it and all that. that really all of that focus on that song came from outside forces, from more like businessy people, maybe that had a better ear than us for what would connect. We were very just like locked into our little Southern California, you know, Inland Empire, LA, Orange County, San Diego scene. Actually, even San Diego.
Well, let me also say that, you know, back then you would re-record stuff. We were so excited. You record something like, or write something like, I want to record this right now. I want people to hear it. And then, you know, someone would say, hey, I'm doing the 7-inch, which case in point, you mentioned Promises a moment ago. I had the first version before Big Choice. It was on, I believe, Stiff Pole Records out of Florida.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so like, that's where I first heard the song. Next thing I know, that's on Big Choice as well. You re-recorded it. So that's just something bands did. You know, a lot of times it was outside influences, be it managers or, you know, hey, your song's getting blown up on K-Rock. We should maybe re-record it. Yep. There was a number of reasons, but, so the record,
I'll try to make my story a little faster. Maybe I'm dragging it out too long.
No, not dragging it at all. I just wanted to make that point.
So we recorded that batch of songs with Don, and then Bill did a couple small things, but he still wasn't putting out the full length. Meantime, Jim Goodwin said, hey, I would like to record your band. I want to work with bands that I like. I like your songs, and I'll record you for free. And I was like, dude, this has got to be some kind of put on. Like, I totally didn't believe
like, it. Who's doing like, this?
What do you get out of it? And he's like, nothing. I just get the experience. I want to put my name on the records that I like. So I went back to Bill and I said, hey, we have this batch, but we've written another half a dozen songs and we'd like to record them. And then Jim is offering to remix the entire album. And Bill was like, it's free. I was like, yeah. And he's like, you want to do it? Said yes. So then we went into a studio called Soundcastle, which was at the time owned by Keith Sweat. It was like this R&B kind of vibe. They didn't make rock records there really. Or anything.
That's crazy.
It's gnarly, right?
And this
was in Silver Lake. And it was a really great time. This was compared, West Beach was one control room with a console and a live room. That's it. You know, Soundcastle had like three live rooms, a couple of mix rooms. Like, it was a big complex. And so we're like, holy shit, like, we've really like hit the big time here, whatever. And
they have two couches in the lounge.
Yeah, exactly. And TVs and a refrigerator. So we were able to, that next batch of songs we recorded, one of them was Disconnected. So that was the first time we'd ever recorded Disconnected, along with another handful of songs. And it's failing me right now. I don't actually remember what the rest of those were. Mm-hmm. Off the top of my head.
Looking to elevate your music career? DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that enables musicians to distribute their music to online stores and streaming platforms such as Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Tidal, and many more. DistroKid collects earnings and payments, sending them to you, the artist. With DistroKid, artists unlock a world of possibilities, from easily paying collaborators with splits to securing your music with DistroLock. DistroKid covers all bases. Plus, you can promote your releases with HyperFollow and create eye-catching visuals with a Spotify Canvas generator, all for free. But that's not all. Introducing the DistroKid app, now available on iOS and Android. Artists can manage their releases, view streaming stats, and withdraw earnings, all from the palm of their hand. And for those looking to perfect their sound, check out Mixia. With its simple interface and customizable mastering options, artists can make their music sound polished and professional within minutes. And don't forget about Instant Share, DistroKid's newest feature. Share large files securely with collaborators, producers, and more, ensuring your music streams at the highest quality. Ready to take your music to the next level? Download the DistroKid app and explore their suite of tools today. Plus, listeners can enjoy 30% off their first year by visiting distrokid.com/VIP/demakes. That's distrokid.com/VIP/demakes.
So anyhow, Disconnected was made at Soundcastle with Jim Goodwin for the first time. And that version is what ultimately would be released as Don't Turn Away. So Donnell Cameron has credit on Don't Turn Away for recording, but
He didn't do all the songs.
He didn't mix everything. So he recorded most of the songs. Jim recorded the rest. And then Jim remixed the songs Don had recorded and mixed the new ones as well. So we would have some kind of, you know, consistency sonically for the record. Okay. And we did spend more time at Soundcastle. And, Jim did give us more direction because we had more time. He'd say, hey, maybe try that line again, sing it this way, or watch your pitch, or, you know, it was a little bit more of a focused kind of recording session. And that is what ultimately ended up being Don't Turn Away. I mean, it was still made on the fly after hours, whenever people weren't working, you know, as the side thing and all that. But that was what would ultimately end up becoming Don't Turn Away. And that's the version of Disconnected that you hear, the one.
Okay. So now I remember hearing the remix, which I really loved. I thought the remix was great. What do you remember the reasoning why you wanted to remix it for the Over It EP? Who didn't think it was up to snuff from a mix standard?
That was when we moved off of, we'll see. So Dr. Strange made the record, and then Fat, we made friends with people at Fat Records, specifically Mike ultimately, but through friends of friends. And when Fatty liked the record and wanted to pick it up from Bill, they were able to make that deal. And then we were at Fat, which was better for us because we had access to, you know, way more bands that we could partner up with and tour. And everyone over at Fat was just more focused on like marketing records and getting them out there. And Bill, for as rad as it was at the time, that he was even willing to spend his own money and help us give us that first hand up. Once Don't Turn Away was released on Doctor Strange, it was a limited edition. It sold out very quickly. And before long we found ourselves at shows with people going, where can I buy your record? I can't find it anywhere. So Fat kind of came in and saved that because they had better distribution, more money. They pressed more records and they basically never let the record go out of print. But we decided after the one record on Fat, we were starting to be courted from other record labels that weren't independent, the evil major labels. And they did turn out to be evil as hell. But I had to find that out for myself. I wasn't willing to take anyone else's word for it.
We all did.
Right. So they were actually able to give us a better advance and some tour support. And it took me from, you know, working in construction to actually being able to have the ability to go on tour. And that was great. So we made that decision. We ended up on a label called Victory Music, not to be confused with Victory Records, the hardcore label.
Correct.
Victory Music was some JVC subsidiary. They were pretty awful, to be honest. It was worse than being on a major. It was being on a smaller version of a major that had major distribution. So, all of the red tape, bureaucracy, and garbage you get with a record label, but without any of the power, clout, or money behind it.
Right. So they're floating in between an identity. Like, are we a major? Or are we an indie? You know?
Yeah, and,
yeah.
For us, it was still a step up, you know, but so what ended up happening is when we did a deal with them and we're like, cool, we're going to make our second album. It's going to be awesome. And they were like, oh, wait a second. We just did a deal with PolyGram for our distribution, and we would like to run a release through it with you guys being a punk rock band, who no one at this label had any idea what punk rock was, what the scene was about, how to market to people. Like, they knew nothing about it. So they're like, could we do like an EP or something that we can run through our distro system and make sure that we are up and running a little bit better before we do a full length? And we said, yeah, we could scrape some songs together for an EP. So it was our choice what songs we used. So we picked some outtakes. We did a new version of I Want, A-OK, which was going to appear on our second album. We did a version of that and a couple other songs that would eventually appear on Big Choice, and Disconnected, because someone at the label liked it and thought we should release it. But their big idea was that we should re-record it. And I don't think we did. So anyway, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. It might've been our manager at the time. He found this guy, Geza X, who was a kind of a Hollywood scenester from the punk rock era, but not very well known. I mean,
why haven't I heard that name? I've never heard that name.
Because he was kind of a scenester, you know.
Did he do any other stuff? I would know.
It was LA stuff. He had a song called Isotope Soap or something. It was a little gimmicky and maybe a little more new wave than punk rock even.
Okay, okay.
Anyway, we went, he was our producer, and I'm doing that with air quotes as I'm saying that. Chad had joined the band at this point, so we had a second guitar player. We'd done a tour of Europe. We were starting to like get more of our legs as like a real touring band that's making records. And he was like wanted performances. So I think we kept the bass and drums and re-recorded vocals and guitars. So the original Jim Goodwin stuff was intact, and we just layered some new guitars, did some new vocals. He tried to produce it, you know, and that's the version that you hear on Over It.
Okay. Yeah. See, I just thought that was a straight up remix. So that was redone to a degree, half and half. That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. There were some tracks that were just kind of reinforced for that. I remember right.
Okay.
We did more with the gang vocal on the chorus, and I definitely remember re-recording a bunch of rhythm guitars and stuff for that.
Now, is this around the time that K-Rock started to play the song? Do you remember if this was, and was that a reason that you ended up re-recording it for Big Choice yet again?
It is, but it was, so this was unbeknownst to us, okay? The people at our new label, when they ran the EP Over It through the new distro system, there were people at, it gets confusing and I don't want to get too inside baseball here, but one of the labels under the PolyGram flag was A&M Records. And they specifically were the marketing label for Victory that we were on. So A&M did the marketing and PolyGram, their bigger company, was the distribution company. So someone at A&M liked the record a lot and they were cheerleading for us, and they slid disconnected off the Over It record to K-Rock. And we were on tour. We hadn't recorded Big Choice yet, I don't think, but we were getting ready to. So, our producer was already set up, Tom Wilson, who had recorded the Offspring's Smash record. And so that made our record label, at least they're like, all right, check that box off, find a producer who's had a hit record in the genre. And then we got Tom. It didn't really work the same for us as it did the Offspring, 'cause the conditions were completely different. But, so we were getting ready to go in and make that record, but we were finishing up a tour. And I remember while we were on tour, I specifically remember this, we were playing a place called Boston's in Phoenix. I don't know if you guys ever played there. This is
not that I recall. 90s. Okay.
Maybe Tempe. It was just outside of Phoenix, that we'd been playing a bunch. And I got the call from our label and they're like, we have amazing news. You just got added to K-Rock. And
which was huge.
It was huge. It was huge. And I didn't even really know what that meant at the time, to be honest. I was like, hey guys, we're on the radio. That's awesome, right? Like, when's the check coming?
Well, I mean, and you know, to this day, if I'm in Southern California, I still hear that song getting played. And you had to, once that hit on K-Rock, you had to notice your audience triple in Southern California.
Absolutely. Yeah. It really blew up our California audience in particular. And then, you know, ultimately what Disconnected would do for us is it would lead to us playing tons of radio shows all across the country to support it and working that whole network of stuff. But at the end of the day, I think it really remained more of a local phenomenon than anything. It's kind of more of a West Coast thing. Mm-hmm. That's what's remained, you know.
Well, you know, and just let me forward ahead for a moment while I can, you know. So when it came to Big Choice, and I remember I bought the cassette. I was still at a cassette, and I was delivering pizzas at the time in Gainesville, Florida, and I had this black truck. And I remember getting it and popping it in. And I was, so I might even have forwarded it because I was just to the song. Well, two things. A-OK was also, I believe, on that 7-inch that Promises out of Stiff Pole Records. So I think that was a re-recording on Big Choice. I could be wrong, but I remember, I specifically remember forwarding because I was like, I got to hear the new version of Disconnected. And it never had the charm of the one that was recorded cheaply for no money to me. How'd you feel about the third?
It probably didn't, because we didn't want to put it on Big
Choice. You could tell.
So I remember being on tour. Like I said, we found out we were on the radio. And then the next call was, we want you to add Disconnected to Big Choice. And we're like, no way in hell, man. That record is done. You know, we were trying to be artists and be purists about everything. And dude, you remember this because we both came up through the 90s. There was a time when punk rock bands were in danger of being labeled a sellout. And it was a constant threat that we lived through that Kill Rock Stars era of, anything flashy or you have any success whatsoever, you've got the punk police on your tail, and they're going to decide whether or not you're cool or not cool or a sellout or if you're down. And we just constantly struggled with that through the 90s. So, and within our own band as well. And I remember that was just such a giant argument as we're traveling in our airport van that we'd converted. And we're having this big major discussion, like, do we put this song on? Don't we? And I think half of us, like, I was one of the advocates. I was like, look, dude, there's no guarantees in this business. We have a little lightning in a bottle right now. We can shoot ourselves in the foot and say no and risk not ever getting airplay again, or we can roll with it. Is it palatable to us as artists? Not so much, but maybe there's a way we can make it less, you know, less horrible.
Well, in my opinion, I wouldn't have done anything different. You made the best choice you could have made. I mean, you had to. And looking back, I now jogged a memory of, I remember you guys had like a, it was like a canned thing before the song on Big Choice. Like, guys, should we do this? Or this is a sellout move or something. Yeah.
So we went back like, and if you remember, like, major labels lived in fear of punk rock bands at that time too. And because it was pop punk was exploding and they knew there was a lot of money to be made. So you knew we weren't a big band, but we had a little bit of power over our label too, because they didn't want to drop us. They just paid all this money. And so we were kind of being like spoiled brats a little bit, like, well, we'll do it, but here are our demands. And our demands were that it appears as a bonus track on the record, so that it would be clear that it wasn't part of our current artistic selection of songs for a record.
Which almost made it stand out worse.
I know, right? And then we had to reinforce that idea by adding a cover, so there would be two bonus tracks, and that's why we put Bikage on the record.
Right.
Also, we thought that was a move to be super credible, because we were giving props to like one of the most defining pop punk bands of all time. And we said, you have to record the skit. We want you guys in the studio, and we want it on tape, whether it's a joke or not, of us expressing our unwillingness to do the song. And then you guys have to be the bad guys. And they're like, we'll do it. They were totally down. So we went in the studio just to specifically record that sketch and nothing else.
That's awesome. Yeah, I remember that.
Ad-libbed. It was just off the cuff. You know, we're like, all right, here's how it's going to go. You say this, we'll say this. And then we just kind of got into it. It was very organic, because it was like we weren't reading from scripts or anything. And I think by that time you can sort of hear that our hearts weren't really in it. Like there are
We've done the same thing where we made a recording for $1,200, and then we went with the big time producer and re-recorded it for $100,000, and the spark's not there because we didn't want to do it. There's so much to be said about emotion and heart and soul that comes through the microphones and through the wires of the guitar and through the drumsticks onto a recording that you just can't replicate. If you just don't want to do it, you can ultimately hear that magic that's not there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the recording process, the songwriting and recording process, they tend to take a life of their own on, right? And if you, we both had experience with this, and I couldn't name, you can name what record you've done this on, because I wouldn't know, but if you've ever made, or we both made records that are quick, you know, maybe you're doing it within a month, all the songwriting, all the recording, everything, boom, done, out. you keep this momentum going through that process. And there's an excitement and a passion and a momentum that doesn't fade. But then if you take like 6 months, 9 months to make a record, and maybe you record here for a month and then you take a couple months off and then you get back to it later, and then maybe it's mixed 3 months later, it's really difficult to keep that momentum up through that process.
So, and the spontaneity.
Yeah. So when you make a song and it's new and it's exciting, it might be raw and it might, you know, not be very well refined like touring would make it into or whatever. But there's usually a spark in that makes it exciting. And then to revisit it 6 months later, when you've already written a whole other batch of songs or you're on to something else creatively, it's sometimes it's difficult. Whether, I mean, the whole I want to, I don't want to plays a role. But I think what's really at the core of that is you've just sort of lost your steam for it. You know, this is a fluid thing. Even, you know, being at this for as long as we have, and we largely play live our music from the early part of our catalog, even now. Mm-hmm. I've gone through several phases with that music as a performer, as an artist, you know, like it feels different to me now than it did when I was 25, but through each of these phases of my own life and my own tastes and music and my emotional connection to the music, you find different ways to connect to it, right? And then the songs start to have these different perspectives or your life kind of, you find different ways to apply the, not only the meaning, but the emotion of the songs to your life and where you're at. Because, you know, when you're a touring band and you do it for decades, you're not the same person through those decades, right? If you can't continue to find a connection to the music that resonates with your audience, then you're going to be out there going through the motions playing it too, right? So there's that aspect of it. But I think it's hard. That aspect of it, I think, is why live records work, right? Because mm-hmm. you continue to relate to the music that you play live, and you can give it the fire of the person you are at that point in time. But when you're dealing in a much shorter time period, say a year, and you record a song and then you within that year you go and re-record it, it's like you're trying to beat the demo or you're trying to recreate some magic that happened. It just doesn't work most of the time.
Yeah. Well, and it's everything you said is spot on. It's it's so funny how, you know, this is such a, most of us as musicians, we're forward thinkers. It's like, yeah, I recorded that yesterday. What's next? I want to move on. But then 25 years later, you're still playing that song because those songs now have memories attached to them that for all those fans. Then those memories are why they're still coming to see you play, you know, and our catalog is from the early days that we play live because they've had the longest time to resonate with the fans as the years have went by. And you know, people have asked, I'm sure you've been asked, well, aren't you sick of playing that song or that song? Every time I get on stage and play whatever, Gainesville, Rock City, it's like the first time again when you get that energy from the crowd. Because I know you're not sitting around when we get off the podcast here, Trevor, I'm probably picking up a guitar and playing Disconnected for the fun of it. You know,
no.
That doesn't happen, right?
Right,
but,
right.
But that energy and the love for that song, it comes right back when we get on stage.
100%. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so,
it's if it's a continual process for you, some people don't have bands for 20, 30 years. Some people do it for 5 years and it's over, or 10. But if you have any longevity at it, you continue to find ways to connect emotionally with the songs that are older. And I guess the point I was trying to make is that's different from that short period of time when a song can just be beaten into the ground or overthought. You know,
sure.
So it's better to get that record made and released and live with it and make the commitment to that. You know, records are like a snapshot in time. So,
yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
And when you re-record songs like we have Disconnected, it's like going through a photo album. You know, you listen to the song, you're like, oh, yeah, that was that time. And you can kind of hear the era in the music, you know.
takes you right back. Well, we're gonna wrap up here. I want to thank you so much for taking the time. When we get off the line here, I'm gonna go to your Wikipedia page and fix all the stuff that's wrong with Disconnected.
Excellent.
thank you. I'm gonna set those bastards straight. Trevor, what would you like the listeners to know? What do you have going on personally with Face to Face? Let everybody know.
Well, like most other bands right now, we're eagerly awaiting the approval to get back out on tour, when it's going to be safe for everyone. We're celebrating our 25th year of the second album, Big Choice, that we've been talking about throughout this podcast.
Congratulations.
And it's a bummer because we're not able to do any shows in honor of it. We had a lot of stuff planned, so maybe by the end of the year we'll see something. We're eagerly awaiting the opportunity to get back out and play live, but other than that, we have been putting the finishing touches on our 10th studio album, and
awesome.
Hopefully that will be released by the end of the year or potentially early next year. So that's been a lot of fun talking about all this writing and recording and the process. Is we've been right in it. And so we're looking forward to being able to share those songs with everybody too real soon.
Awesome. Well, I am looking forward, as I'm sure all our listeners are. So again, thank you for making the time to discuss this. And I'm super stoked that you picked Disconnected.
Yeah, man. Great talking with you. I look forward to us hanging out again soon.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know, where each week I will preview a select band of my choice that you may or may not know. If you'd like your band to be previewed on Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is submit your song and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. All I ask for is a good quality recording of a song you feel best represents your band. This week's featured band is What You're Made Of from Sydney, Australia, featuring Jeremy McCowage on lead vocals, Liam Henderson on bass, Bailey Brown on lead guitar, Anthony Moon on rhythm guitar, and Sam Henderson on drums. You can find their music on Spotify. And I got to hand it to these guys. They got the best song title so far on the Band You Might Not Know segment. Here's a snippet of their song, What Does Marcellus Wallace Look Like?
It seems that I am only chasing safety. I couldn't care less. And all your friends. You're not what I need, but you are what I breathe. And it's suffocating.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
So hell yeah, man. Disconnected, I have very fond memories of being a teenager and being in my buddy Mike Kowalczuk's driveway skateboarding. He had built a couple little ramps and listening to Disconnected in a CD boombox and skating to it. It's a perfect song to skate to. It's an awesome punk rock song. It's like a very definitive 90s punk rock song. So awesome. And it was so cool to hear the story behind it.
Yeah, man, what a driving riff that is. You know, I remember not maybe the first time I heard it, but I remember the first time I heard Face to Face, and I was just blown away. Their melodies and song structures were instantly catchy, and I was convinced that this band was going to be, at the time, I'm like, these guys are going to be the biggest punk band ever, and they've had an amazing career, not to take anything away from them, but I thought the world was theirs. I just always loved their songs, and this song in particular just has legs. It's just the one defining song, and I was so stoked that Trevor decided to discuss it.
Right. I didn't realize that it still had this radio presence in California. You know, I'm all the way in Pittsburgh, and, you know, on the radio, we hear Nirvana and Stone Temple Pilots. Nothing wrong with that. But, you know, we're not hearing too much punk rock. And I didn't realize until this interview that was something that you would still regularly hear on the radio in Southern California.
Oh, and I wasn't making that up. That's the honest truth. Every time I'm out there, it'll be like, you know, sandwiched between Pearl Jam and Smashing Pumpkins will be disconnected. It's like, wow. It's a staple out there. And yeah, it's just kind of woven into the Southern California fabric, so to speak.
Right. And so the version that you hear on the radio, is it the Big Choice version or is it the original or what? Because I know you guys had talked about that. And you guys had also talked about how you can't really capture the magic on the re-recording of a song. So do you remember which version it was?
As far as I remember and know, every time it's the first version. It's the one on wow. the original release. Yeah, there's something about that version. Maybe it's not as sonically clean or as played as technically proficient as the Big Choice version, but there's some unbridled energy there that lightning in a bottle stuff. You know, we talk about how songs are written quickly, and in this case, this song was according to Trevor recorded quickly. It was put out there, and it has resonated with people. It's just the definitive version of the song, in my opinion.
Right, and it was interesting how he said that they didn't necessarily think that song was special or stood out from the rest of the songs that they were recording at the time. So it's really interesting how people latch onto songs. And I can speak to that because that was the song from Don't Turn Away that stood out to me. And it wasn't particularly because I had heard it otherwise. I didn't hear it like on some comp or something like that. I just... that song stood out to me, and it might be that, you know, like that thing, which he had talked about that they had kind of been inspired by that Fugazi song, that it's just undeniably catchy, you know, and obviously the melodies and the lyrics just drove it home. But, there's something about that that's really cool.
Oh yeah, for sure. And it's not necessarily even my favorite Face to Face song. It's not. I have other favorites, but definitely undeniable and definitely instantly catchy. And it's become their signature song. I love the song, but they have a ton of amazing songs. And how many times have we heard that in the episode where it was just another song in the batch of songs that the band was recording that somehow became bigger than life amongst the fans? It's an incredible story that we keep hearing over and over.
And you've experienced that. I know that I've experienced that with Punchline, with which songs stick out to people. And you've experienced that in Less Than Jake. You guys didn't necessarily know which songs people were going to love. Did you think people were going to love Johnny Quest Thinks We're Sellouts so much?
I don't think we were thinking about it. I was 19 when I wrote that. So it was just a song that we wrote one night over a few beers at our warehouse. You know, it wasn't any grand master plan that, people are going to love this song. And we just started playing it. But quickly, very early on, it became one of those songs that people were requesting and wanted to hear. And it became, I keep saying it, but it took on a life of itself that the band at some point, you have no control over that. The fans dictate that.
Right, for sure. And Punchline, I had that experience. It's an old Punchline song, but we had this song called Heart Transplant that, I don't know, we recorded our album Action, and we thought that as a whole that we were really proud of the album, but that song, something about that song, I think with our song, it was one of those relationship songs. Not that most of our songs at that time weren't that, but there's just, yeah, sometimes there's just something about a song that really people just latch onto and you can't explain it.
Yeah, and again, it was really cool. I thought that Trevor not only picked this song, but he's another artist that is kind of humble about it. You know, for many reasons, people get sick of talking about their hit, and certainly he's probably done his fair share of talking about Disconnected over the years. But he was very forthcoming and humble with it, and it to me, it just made for a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Hell yeah, man! So did I.
All right, everybody, I want to thank you once again for your absolute generosity for the charity this month, which is Big Brothers and Big Sisters of the Laurel Region. Thank you so much for your donations. It's a wonderful cause, and we feel so happy to be able to help them out. It's been a rough year for charities and donations, and you know, we here at Krista Makes a Podcast are just trying to give back to wonderful organizations, and we want to thank each and every one of you. Thank you so much.
And, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, I've said this before, I'll say it again. It's a free podcast. We're not charging anything. So even if you could donate a buck or $2, less than the cost of a beer if you would go out to a bar or something, to our monthly organizations, we'd really appreciate it. It's ChrisDemakesADifference.com. And, you know, the a dollar or two among thousands of people could go a long way. So, yeah, thank you, guys.
Yes, and if you'd like to record a first version of your song, I know some place that that people could do that at, Chris.
You do?
I certainly do. So, you know, I've mentioned recently that we musicians are trying to navigate our way through not being able to tour right now. And everybody in my band, I'm so proud of everybody. We all have our own little projects going on. And I want to give a shout out right now to our drummer, Mr. Matt Yonker. We also call him Matt Drastic. He owns a studio in Nashville. He'd love to record, mix, master, produce your record. It's called Drastic Sounds Studio. Yeah, Matt's studio is killer. I just recorded a couple songs with him a couple weeks ago for a side project I have coming out, and he's a blast to work with. He's got a bunch of great gear, guitars. If you sweet talk to me, he might even play on your record. He's a hell of a drummer. You could reach him at drasticsounds.com. That'll link to his Instagram where you can direct message him, or you can email him at drasticsoundstn@gmail.com. That's drasticsoundstn@gmail.com, and he will take good care of you. He comes highly recommended, and tell him that I said hello.
Yeah, and I can testify to that. I heard the recordings you were talking about, and I've heard a lot of stuff that Matt has recorded. It sounds awesome. Matt's an awesome guy. I can't imagine how cool it would be to spend several days in a row with him recording music. And yes, he's an awesome drummer too.
So, yeah, no, he's yeah. He's
really, second that.
Thanks, Chris. Now, he's really easy to work with. And the great thing is, even if you're not in Nashville and you're not going to actually physically be there to record, you can send him your projects to mix and master. He does an amazing job with that. So please hit him up. That'd be awesome. And man, I'm gonna steal your words here, Chris. Another great episode this week, man.
Yep. We are like 18 episodes in, and I feel like they've all been 5-star episodes. And if you don't believe me, you could look at our reviews on iTunes, because people are giving us mad 5 stars. And if you haven't done that yet, go leave us a review. We like reviews, whether it's just the stars or if you want to write something. What's really cool is sometimes somebody will write something in the reviews, and then I'll screenshot it and send it to Chris, and then we both of our hearts swell, and we feel really happy, and it makes us want to make podcasts forever. So yeah, thank you guys for that. If you haven't done it yet, maybe do that.
And if you get a chance, please join our Facebook podcast group. It's Krista Makes a Podcast Facebook group. We'd love to have you join us there. It's a lot of fun. And yeah, until next week, we'll see you then.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan. And this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.